The nature of life is change. I always say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now we're getting into it, so I guess we should call it an official start. Let's see. Welcome, friends, to yet another episode of River of Suck Podcast. I believe this is the 23rd episode. Today, our super special guest is Jason Lai, who's a conductor, not just any conductor. He's a coach and a presenter and a speaker. And I just met him like 2 days ago on the internet. I was like, this guy is awesome. We got to talk more. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Andy. I'm so honored to be part of your podcast. And I love the name of your podcast, The River of Suck. It's awesome. It's really great. What is it about? I mean, why did you call it that?
So I had a mentor when I was at Berklee College of Music named John McGann, and he's sadly passed on. But in our lessons, let's just say that I needed him as a teacher. He was perfect. And he was like, you have to suck at something before you can be good at it. You have to just swim across the river of suck and just revel in that process where it's gross. And it's turned into this like giant expanded metaphor in my life.
So, I love that. That's really great, that metaphor. Truly great.
Let's just show you what it's all about here. You're on one side of the river of suck. You're on your comfort shore. Behind you is your comfort cave. This is where you do all the things you already know how to do. Comfort zone, easy, happy, no problem. On the other side, which looks impossible and far away, totally unattainable by a mere mortal such as myself, yourself, oneself. And the problem is the giant chasm between our comfort shore and the other side. Because that chasm is a raging whitewater river of rapids, rocks, and
piranhas. I hear you.
So those thought piranhas are all those negative thoughts that appear in our head to try and sabotage our good vibes when we're trying to get in that flow state, be creative, be the person that we want to be. But then we get those thoughts of, I'm not good enough. What do they think of me? Why do I belong here? And so on. So I'm really excited to hear your thought piranhas. The theory, though, is that if you have a plan about how you could use small steps in your practicing or the way that you structure your life, maybe the impossible seeming goals, you can build a raft or swim, being bitten by thought piranhas as you swim, and slowly but surely, in tiny, imperceptible to you increments, you might eventually reach the other side, that goal that you so wanted. And when you get there, it's amazing, but you realize there's so much more and you're at comfort shore and there's a new other side sprouting in all different directions. So that's the river of suck.
I love it. I really love it. And I can totally relate to that. Totally relate to that. Many thought piranhas in my life, many rapids, and the other side does seem so far away, but I've got a lifetime to get to the other side, and I'm looking forward to the journey.
Yeah. Yeah, I always quote my favorite snowboarder, Jeremy Jones. He says, the journey is the reward, and I love that so much.
Yeah, totally. And often we're so asleep, we're not awake, we don't see the journey. We're so tunnel vision. We don't look out the windows and we don't observe life and the beauty and the joy of things happening to us. We tend to just kind of sleep through it. And then, you know, what happens? When do we wake up?
That is a really good question. When do we wake up?
Sometimes I guess we wake up when terrible things happen, I guess, or tough things happen. That's one thing. That's one awakening. I know that because my mum passed away three years ago of pancreatic cancer in the space of 3.5 months. And it was devastating to the family because, you know, I saw her as a healthy, she was a very proud, very strong woman, and she was active and everything. And then suddenly she started getting pains, and then she was diagnosed. And then 3.5 months later, we were at her funeral, and it was just devastating. And those kind of, those events really make you wake up, actually.
Wow.
Really do make you wake up.
That's wild. I'm so sorry, man.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put a downer on our conversation, but I think I'm just saying that because I want your listeners to be aware that these really tough events can actually really change you. And I have totally a different view of life and death now. And actually, that's her gift, biggest gift to me was for me to see that. And so I'm so grateful to her. I'm so grateful to have been her son, you know, but I'm also grateful that she's left me this wonderful way of seeing what life can be and knowing that death awaits us all. So don't worry about it. You know, go and tackle those thought piranhas, go through those rapids.
Yeah.
And you'll see something of something will reveal itself to you.
Wow. That's powerful. Yeah. I mean, it's life, you know, life is not filled with positivity every moment. And I try to be an optimist, but I call myself a realistic optimist I'm kind of pessimistic for an optimist. and the without this contrast of joy and sorrow, I mean, isn't that the definition of comedy even? So
absolutely.
So it's just, life is weird. Life is death, and death is life. You can't have one without the other. So,
yeah. I love that idea of the, you know, the Vanitas paintings, where there's a certain period in art history where people used to, you know, get a nice portrait of themselves, but include a skull in the painting, just to let you know, just to make everyone aware, including the person in the picture, that death awaits us all. And so it's not a morbid thing. It's just to say, I'm alive and I look wonderful in this painting that someone's done of me, but also death awaits me. And I think that's really awesome, because it's like when you know that, you know, the thing that we're born with, the only certainty we're born with is that we're going to die. You know,
yeah.
People say death and taxes, but some people avoid taxes, but you cannot avoid death, right? You cannot escape it. So don't worry about it.
Gosh. Yeah. Wow, that's wild. So I want to backtrack a little bit, and I want to hear more of your story. So we met like 2 days ago on the internet. We were both on a panel together for a program called 12 Petals, which brings music to people who need it, and mentorship across the world from experts, and it's really, really cool. So in the panel, I was like, I wonder what Jason thinks about this. I had stepped on the moderator's toes. I read a question from the chat to you directly. I thought that was
awesome. That was great. The moderator wants us to do that. It's fun.
I want to hear more of your story. Like, where did you come from? What was your journey? And how did your, I know you talked a lot about imposter syndrome. So tell me more about your journey.
Sure. Well, I'm my parents were born in Hong Kong. They emigrated in 1965 to UK, and that's where I was born. A few years later, I was born and I was educated there. So I'm British, hence the accent. But but I grew up knowing that I was in England and I was British, but I knew I was also Asian. So I grew up in this kind of Asian household, but very accepting of Western and Asian culture. And it was, I have to say, on most part of it was a lovely childhood. I remember lovely things about it, but one of the hardest things was the bullying, because the racial discrimination, because, you know, I looked different to everyone else. And so people, kids being kids, would pick on that, would say, okay, you look different, therefore I'm going to make that difference known to you. And it's like, dude, I know that I look different. You don't need to make that known to me. But you know, but it's very painful for someone, you know, to squint their eyes and to do like Bruce Lee moves, thinking that they're funny. So that was difficult, I have to admit, growing up in that way.
Mm.
And eventually I found music at the age of 10. I actually watched a movie I still think it's a great movie, but some people think it's cheesy. It's called Electric Dreams, and it was about a cellist and a computer falling in love with the sound of a cello. And I actually fell in love with the sound of the cello.
Whoa. I have not seen that.
This is a great movie.
I need to see that.
Go to see it. Giorgio Moroder wrote the music. Philip Oakley, Giorgio Moroder, the theme tune to that. And I still love that theme tune. It's very disco, very poppy, but it's fantastic. The pop song that was tied to that movie. But it's a really extraordinary movie, well before AI came along.
Yeah. And just to be clear, because I just looked this up, this is a film from 1984. There's also now a TV series made in 2017 and 2018. And it's
No, I didn't know that.
I know. Sorry to pour water on your electric dreams, but yeah.
I need to check that out.
The world has moved on.
Yeah. And this was totally before AI came along. And this really intriguing movie about this computer that suddenly had a brain of its own. But I focused on the cellist. Virginia Madsen was playing the cello. Mm. And I don't think she can really play the cello, but she looked like she was a cellist. And the sound was really awesome. And they kept playing this a minuet in G by Bach. Mm-hmm. So I suddenly became transfixed on the cello and on Bach. And so that's why I started learning the cello and then quickly the piano and then quickly started to compose. And so that led on to going to various music schools to read music at Oxford. And then eventually I won this competition, this conducting competition, the BBC Young Conductors Conducting Competition. And that's what really launched my career. And yeah, wow. But I just feel that journey of being a musician is hard. And you know this, Andy. I mean, you know the imposter syndrome. You know how we talked a lot about this, right? Being on stage and a feeling that, do I deserve to be here? Are people kind of criticizing me or thinking I'm rubbish?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, and still it's there. But I'm beginning to, those thought piranhas are beginning, I'm beginning to kind of like bash them away.
Yeah.
And I think I'm understanding that I actually have gifts, I have talents, and I'm going to show them and share them with the world. And I have those gifts.
Yeah.
But it took a while. It took a while. I remember, like I shared with you the other day, it took a while when I remember standing on the podium the first day in front of the orchestra after the competition, because I won a job from that competition. And I was 26, 27. And I remember saying to myself, gosh, what can I teach these people who are in front of me, who have been in the orchestra for 26 and 27 years? You know, what can I, this little squirt, teach these wonderful, wonderful, trained, erudite, mature musicians? And so it was really, you know, it was like that terror I had to face. And I think every young conductor faces that terror. Every young musician faces that terror, right?
Yeah. I think you're so right about the time. A lot of our kind of internal issues with imposter syndrome, I think, can be resolved by just doing it more over time. And it's like, if you've been doing this long enough, you accept, well, this is what I do. Yes. So I must belong here. But right. It's so hard to like jump into something that you're only going to be ready for after you've done it. So I think where people get stuck a lot is like wishing it could happen now. But in art, at least in music and art, like if you don't have the most tenacity in the world, you are screwed, because there's like thousands of other people who want it more than you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. And also there's this thing about it being having to be, it being perfect, it has to be perfect. It's so sacred to me. It's so wonderful, and I must share it, but it has to be perfect. Otherwise I won't be happy. Oh. And that's a killer, because we need to screw up.
Yeah.
We need to mess up so we can see what we're facing, and we can see that actually we can learn from it. Every time I screw up, I learn something from it.
Absolutely. So let's talk about screwing up. Yeah. Can you think of a time where you just horribly messed it up?
Yeah. I mean, many times. It's like in concerts, suddenly in the early days when I started beating something and I actually didn't know where I was in the bar, in the piece. I suddenly lost my where I was, and it was so frightening. It was like it's akin to you driving a car and closing your eyes for 30 seconds while you're driving. It felt terrifying. And I kind of kept going, thinking, oh God, if I just keep beating, the orchestra will bail me out. And it just got slower and slower and slower. And I just got so frightened. And I remember just leaving that podium thinking, oh my word, what the hell just happened? And for days I was so depressed.
And then, but did you hear about it from the musicians or the audience?
There you go. You see, no one batted an eyelid.
They thought that was your artistic choice.
Right, wow. Right.
Isn't yeah. really
yeah.
extracting the emotional ooze from this moment in a right. way that nobody ever has before.
And you'd be so surprised at how no one really knows. I remember another occasion where I was conducting a film music concert, and I was conducting Star Wars. And for some reason, in the beginning, it was I think it was either I was conducting in two in the rehearsal, and I said to them, I'll do this in four. Come to the concert, half of them probably didn't pick up on that. And so they thought I was conducting two and I was conducting four. Oh. And this chaos ensued. But luckily, the beginning of that piece sounds like it's chaos coming together. Hey. So when I asked my friends, and actually I remember in the concert, I calmly just stopped the orchestra. I then held up my fingers like that. And I'm holding up four fingers to mean I'm going to conduct in four. I'm going to go back. And I started. No one knew. My friends didn't know. I said to them, I'm so sorry about the mess up. What mess up? So we kind of get ourselves into this kind of, oh no, I screwed up. I'm so bad, so terrible. And then no one knows.
Apologizing for your lack of perfection.
Yeah.
The mistake. Yeah. I like to say it's never a mistake until you admit to it.
I remember you said the other day on the podcast, on the meeting, the panel thing that we had, that you said, that you don't grimace, don't let the audience know, you just kind of smile and go with it. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. The smile can get me into trouble if you know me, because now I have like I just posted a video yesterday. I think it was yesterday. And I won't name this video. You don't know what day is yesterday if you're listening later. Ha!
Right.
For my taste, I thought it was a tiny bit sloppy, but I thought it was good enough. So I had to battle my inner perfection demon. But the habit that I've developed when I make a mistake is to smile wider. Because I think it at least embodies the humor of a mistake and allows you to move on from it, which is the most important thing for me as an improviser. I just have to keep, and for someone who plays music that's meant for dancing a lot of the time, the rhythm is more important. So if you screwed up a note, whatever, if you screwed up the timing, don't screw it up more because you screwed it up back there. Let's get back on the boat, on the bus. So, but I had a student who was like, oh yeah, I saw you smile a little bit in the middle of it. I was like, uh-oh.
But to be fair, your default is smiling, which is really wonderful. I mean, you know, you have a very smiley face. And so it's kind of, people have to really know you to know that, you know, if you're.
But if, interestingly though, that has taken me a lot of time to develop. I used to have a resting grumpy face growing up.
Really? How did you develop that? Because I think I have resting grumpy face sometimes. How do you develop that?
I think you have to think about it, because there's like, you have to bring it from the conscious level to the unconscious level, and that requires thinking about it. And in the River of Suck world, I think everyone wants to skip the step where they have to be conscious of their thinking. Right. You're like, I just want to feel the music, man. Right. I don't want to have to think about it. Well, think of like using your brain. Doesn't mean that the music isn't flowing. It just means like you're counting and you're going to come in on the right beat, or you're aware of the way that your face and body language affect how people respond to what you say. And having been misunderstood disastrously over and over throughout my life, I'm trying really hard. So So that's I guess, yeah, I'm trying to be a fun, smiley person without resting grumpy face.
Well, that really comes across to me, Andy, when I first, you know, from when he just meeting you 2 days ago, it comes across. So you've obviously, for me, it's the thing that you were saying, bringing that unconscious to consciousness is the awareness.
Yeah.
And for me, that's a big, big deal to suddenly become aware of who I am. What am I doing in life? And what am I feeling about what I'm feeling in life? For me, one of the big things about being an integral coach, so I coach people as well, is the alignment of this kind of thinking, reasoning center that most people are stuck in their heads.
Yeah.
This kind of emotional center that you know, you can think about the music, but are you feeling the music? And then this kind of body center, which is what I call the somatic center, that if I'm a conductor, I need to show the music in my body, right? So yeah. I have to have an alignment of the head, the heart, and the body to actually show up as a conductor. And so I think I would just encourage everyone out there, whether you're a musician or not, to really be aware of those centers, what's happening in those centers.
Yeah. Do you think there's a connection between conducting an orchestra from a podium and dancing?
Totally. I'm a terrible dancer, but I've been told, my friends say, but you dance on the podium. And I go, oh. So it's interesting. I think, yeah, I think you've got to feel rhythm in your soul, just as, you know, I mean, as a musician yourself, and you do a lot of popular music, you have to go from jazz to swing to all kinds of things, right? And it's a feeling, it's just a manipulation of the rhythm and the stress, right? And the feeling of it in your body.
Well, I'm just sort of realizing something right now, which is that, like, I consider the wind and ambient noise to be part of music. Okay. And yeah. That's of course made, you know, popular by John Cage and his
that's right.
silent piano piece. But in a way, I wonder if dancers think about all movements as part of dance.
I wonder. I wonder. I remember I used to, when I was at music school, we used to have some ballet students join us for music lessons as well. We used to see them walking across the yard, and they used to walk in a very odd way with their feet pointing outwards, and they had this beautiful poise. And I often wondered, how are they thinking about the way they walk, about the way they move, or is it just a very natural progression? Do they think about every movement they make? I wonder.
Yeah, I think I'm going to expand my all sound is music to all existence is art.
Yeah. Did you see recently this thing that came on the news that Sweden commissioned this guy to do a painting.
Yes, I did see that.
Right. And
I don't know if our listeners saw it, so keep going.
Yeah. So I forgot what the commission was, but they were expecting.
I remember what the commission was.
What was the commission?
A decade earlier, this artist had made a piece of art with a lot of money in the art to make a statement about money.
Yes. So obviously the people that commissioned it were expecting a canvas with something on it.
Yeah.
He delivered a blank canvas, totally blank, not a single.
Two blank canvases.
Right, two blank canvases. And when he was quizzed about what they were, why, where's the art? And he said, this is the art. I've taken the money and I've run, and this is what I'm giving you. I just thought that was genius.
And the name of the piece is Take the Money and Run.
Right, okay. So, you know, that's art. Everything is art, I guess. Everything is art these days, you know.
So let's go back to being a coach for a second and this body language thing.
Yeah.
And this is something I've struggled with. Like just perception. How important is it that we're aware of our body language when we're, I mean, I guess both do in our daily interactions, but also when we're public speaking or in front of people doing whatever it is that we do, whether that's art or music or anything.
I'd go back a stage further and say, it's even more important to feel yourself, your body, let alone be on stage in front of other people and show your body language. A lot of us, yeah. Most of us are not even aware of what's happening in our bodies. The stresses, the gut reaction, you know, you have a feeling in your gut, that's your body telling you something. You know, a lot of people I know burn out. The thing is, your body has been telling you for months that you're going to burn out, but we simply don't listen to our bodies, right? Mm. So I'd say the first stage is to even just sit there, right, as you're listening to this podcast and say, what am I feeling in my stomach? What am I feeling in my feet, in my legs and my arms? What's going on? Where can I feel the tension in my body? That just as a basic thing. So when I'm meditating, I do a body scan. Every time I meditate, I either end or begin the meditation with a body scan, just so I can really be in the moment and really be in tune with what's going on. And I agree with you that the next stage, once you know your own body, then start kind of like examining how it appears, how you're showing it to the world. You know, like people with so-called resting, you know, BITCH face. Are they aware of that? Are they aware of that? And actually, maybe it's just your face, but you know, smiling requires less muscle use than frowning. Frowning takes right. more muscles and more energy to do that, right? But right. smiling actually takes less. So, and I talk a lot about body language to my conducting students and to my clients who I'm coaching. You know, the openness of your body can actually invite conversation, can invite connection, can invite collaboration. And your closed body makes people just want to go away from you, or they're worried that they're, walking in on your space.
Yeah, you said something really interesting there about. So one of the things I'm always trying to strive towards, and I know a lot of people are too, is to be in that flow state. As you said, to be in the moment, but you were saying to take a step back and observe yourself to be in the moment more. Now, a lot of people think about to be in the moment, they'd want to shut off their brain and just experience. But it sounds like you're saying that to fully be there in the moment, you might even have to use your, think about it, use the conscious mind, and that may even increase your flow state.
I agree. The conscious mind is important, not kind of going on autopilot, but being fully conscious about what's going in your head. Wow. Most of us have monkey minds. Observe yeah. your monkey mind. Don't shut it down. Observe it.
Yeah.
Let it be there. You know, take a step back from it as if you're viewing it on a cinema screen.
The movie of your life.
That's right. Yeah. Totally. I mean, the consciousness, you know, it's trying to, the awareness is so, like I said earlier on, most of us will spend our lives asleep, unfortunately, to ourselves, to what we're feeling, to how we're affecting other people. So, you know, when you wake up, the first stage of waking up is to the awareness. And that awareness, you can practice all the time. We can be aware right now, as I said, listening to this podcast, be aware of what you're hearing, our voices. Yeah. Is your mind going in other places? Are you thinking about dinner tonight? Have you phoned your partner? You know, what are you thinking about? Are you fully listening to what's going on? Are you listening to my voice? am I going to go closer into the mic and do one of those, you know, really kind of strange voices?
Really, really close to the mic.
Quiet. That's right. What's it called? An ASMR kind of video.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very close now.
Very close. So listen to yourself like that. Listen to yourself really closely. Really examine yourself. You're very interesting. You are so interesting. Be curious about yourself.
Yeah. The closer in and the quieter we get, the more profound it gets.
I agree. Totally agree.
You know, one of the reasons I'm smiling and laughing so much is because we're talking about suffering through life. Really, I think we're, part of what we're talking about is suffering and not always being happy with how it went and ourselves and trying to improve ourselves. And I just think if you can't laugh at that,
yeah,
we're in trouble.
Totally. I don't know if the Buddha said this or a monk said this to someone, you know, if there's a problem and you can do something about it, then relax. If there's a problem and you can't do something about it, then relax. So it's just, you know, just, you know.
You can worry all you want. The same thing is going to happen.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I think you're right. I think this journey of suffering that we go on can be seen in a variety of ways, can be seen as, oh, woe is me. Mm. I'm going to step into my hole and not come out, and I'm going to be sorry for myself. Or I'm suffering, but I'm going to see what I can learn from it.
Yeah.
Right? It's up to us. It's up to you how you are, how you want to show up, how you want to swim in that river of suck, right?
That's right. And so in that river of suck, we have our thought piranhas. We have come to dun 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 thought piranhas.
Oh my god.
Jason Lai.
They're welcome chewing at me already.
The thought piranha game. What thought piranha, you know, and I heard you speaking previously on our panel about being a conductor and being suddenly thrown into a leadership role and not being totally prepared for that situation. So I'm wondering if you could speak about those thought piranhas then, when it seems to me like that was like an area of very deep conflict for you.
Very deep, because it's like I lost my confidence. I thought, you know, winning the competition, I'm great. Look at me. I'm so wonderful. And then suddenly you're there and it's like, oh my gosh, can I actually do this? And I remember sharing with you also on the panel that I had a problem with authority, because, you know, my dad, bless him, I love him to bits, but he was an angrier person in his former days and used to take it out on us. And also I was picked on largely by white males. And so I've always had this fear, firstly, of white males, and secondly, of authority figures. And so when I was having to stand up on the podium in front of this orchestra and be authoritative, suddenly those thought the piranhas were going, you're afraid of being in authority. What the hell are you doing standing here? You don't deserve to be here. Get off. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. All those piranhas biting up my ass. Yeah.
I'm making piranha gestures.
You are, yes.
Get off the stage. You don't belong here.
Right. Yeah. Ugh. You know, you don't know what authority is. You have no idea. So, and you're so weak and so mild-mannered and so polite, you won't be able to stand up against these really tough, seasoned professional musicians.
So what happened?
So at that time, you know, I was young. I kind of managed, you know, somehow you have this kind of what I call true nature, inner strength, something that helps you get through something. You know how as musicians we need an ego, we need to have narcissism, healthy ego, healthy narcissism. The problem is when it gets unhealthy on both counts, then things begin to happen. Then you become, you know, a narcissist, a sociopath. So somehow I managed to support myself with some kind of inner strength. It's only in the last 5 or so years that I've realized, through the coaching, the course that I went through mum's death, that actually there is this strong self that I have, this you will not be able to get rid of this burning fire I have inside me. You simply cannot touch it with all your words, with all your unkindness in the world, or whatever. You won't be able to touch that. You'll never be able to quench that fire. No matter how much water you pour on it, it won't go out. And so now I realize the gifts that I have. And I guess there was a spark of that when I was starting out, that inner core there was there, that support. And it's just taken its time to really reveal itself.
How do we turn these dreams into the self-confidence thing? And what does healthy narcissism mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the first count, I think I remember being, I have a spiritual coach and I go to these retreats, and I remember the wise lady who is our teacher, she said, you know, I don't know why people come to these retreats and say, fix me, because you're not broken.
Mm.
And when I heard that, something in me just gave way, right? And I just thought, wow, I'm not broken. And I thought I was broken. None of us are broken, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And that was exactly what I thought. Wow. So, yeah. And so in answer to your other part of the question, unhealthy narcissism, it's when we believe, it's when I think it's about the persona, the personality.
Mm-hmm.
We start believing in that personality too much. It gets out of control, you know? I think our work in life is to get rid of that personality. The thing that has been created since childhood over time stays on you like a piece of armor. And so you begin to believe things about yourself that I'm not this, I'm right. not that. I can do this, but I can't do that. That stuff right. starts sticking, clinging to you like an awful, mold or something. And then it hardens like an armor that no one can get into and you can't release yourself. So when you start to do this self-development work, you start picking at all of that stuff and start taking off your armor. And for sure, you're going to feel vulnerable for a time. You're going to feel those arrows and you're going to feel the heat of life for a bit. But stay with it. Stay with it, because that fear, that kind of hurt is going to teach you so much about yourself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can get rid of your narcissism if you're aware of it. Your former president probably wasn't aware of it. I don't know. I don't want to start getting political on this chat, but there are some people that just simply aren't aware that they're narcissists, right? Yeah. And so it's your job to be aware, because no one is going to help you do that. You have to be self-aware.
A little self-awareness could go a long way.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
I remind myself of that all the time. All my self-awareness comes from reminding myself to be self-aware.
Right. And remind yourself you're not broken, Andy.
Yeah.
You're not broken.
Well, I'm a person, and I believe perfection is the enemy of getting things done. So yeah. I don't think I'm broken, but I'm on a path. I'm on a journey and I'm not done yet. So
yeah.
So my healthy narcissist wants to say, I have more to say. So don't kill me yet. I'm not done. I'm not done here. I've got more.
I think also that the unhealthy narcissism comes when we project onto others, when we project things and we start to act out. So yes. For instance, you know, if you're angry, be angry and actually tap into the energy of anger. But if you start swearing, verbally abusing and throwing stuff at someone, physically assaulting someone, that's when your anger is way out of control.
No doubt.
That's when your narcissism is way out of control. So be with that, the source of that energy, but don't act out on it.
Well, so this dark, we all have a dark side.
We do, the shadow side. I love it.
The shadows. Ooh, the shadow side. The shadow side.
That's right. Yeah. Loving it. Close mic work.
What is your shadow side? And what are the healthy ways or unhealthy ways that your shadow side emerges?
So, gosh, my shadow side. So for a long time, I couldn't take criticism.
Ooh.
I just couldn't take it. And I hated it. And so I would just avoid it. So I would just avoid being in a position where people could give me feedback.
Oh, and how did that go?
Well, obviously not very well, because, you know, when people give you feedback, it was like someone was literally plunging a knife into my heart. Oh. And they weren't. It was very supportive feedback often, right?
Yeah.
But I would take it as, oh my God, you do not love me.
Yeah.
Right? And that's total BS, because they're trying to be kind and supportive and try to help you grow. And feedback is really important. That's the self-awareness is feedback. Is self-feedback, right?
Yeah. You know?
So yeah, feedback was something in my shadow. And actually, this kind of jealousy of other people doing well. Oh my God, how the hell did he get that concert? How the hell did she get that post with that orchestra? why did I not get that post? And then you'd kind of swim around in this awful fog of jealousy, and it would eat at you like a cancer. Yeah. So I've embraced those now. I've embraced the fact that I find feedback difficult, and I ask for feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I say, give me feedback. Let me know what you feel and what you think. And I'll just thank you for it. And I may disagree or agree with you, but thank you so much for that. The jealousy thing. I stay with the jealousy. I stay with, what is this feeling of jealousy? Where am I feeling it? Is it in my heart? Is it in my head? Is it in my foot? Where is it coming from? And why? What is it about jealousy that's triggering me now? So I'm very curious about my shadow side.
Hmm. Yeah. So
what about your shadow side?
My shadow side, I like grim, dark things. And I've always loved horror movies. And
what's your favorite horror movie?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I have one. There's
Evil Dead. It's got to be Evil Dead, no?
So yeah, awesome. Yeah. Evil Dead. Yeah. Sure. There you go. That's How did you know?
Or Exorcist.
I have no idea how you knew that. Yeah. That's so super wild. Bruce Campbell is one of my big heroes.
Oh, he's great.
If chins could kill. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay. Evil Dead. So I guess for me, the horror and the humor have always been linked, and I've been drawn to things that are gross, terrifying, and hilarious. The best way for me to get it out, of course, and some of our listeners know from my podcast with Josh Holder, owner of the Frightmare Compound Haunted House, that the fact that we're now in our second year of running our own haunted house. And I'm volunteering for fun, for no money, in my friend's haunted house, the Empty Grave. I get to put on a mask and I get to scare people, and I get to like lurk in the corner quietly and then jump out and then follow them. And that lets me get out these weird emotions in a way that I haven't found any other outlet for. There, because you can't do this stuff in public.
Well, you can, but you'd be arrested.
Right, exactly. You're basically harassing as a scare actor. You're either being paid or volunteering. Nobody does this for money, because even if it's paid, it's minimum wage. I think there's just anyone who gets to the point where they're working inside a haunted house and they've got the mask on. They have found that their inner darkness should come out, and they're going to feel better if they allow it to flow. When you keep it inside, I think it can lead to a lot of problems. And I'm not even sure how to define those problems, because when you release something that's been trapped, it's the best feeling in the world. It literally doesn't get any better than releasing a trapped feeling.
What is that? I was going to ask you, what is that? How does that impact you? What is that feeling when you have this mask and you're doing this scaring? What's going in your, what's in your body? What's in your mind?
Well, in my body and mind, I am trying to get inside of a character first and foremost, because it's no longer me anymore. Like, for example, my friend's haunted house in Longmont. It's called the Empty Grave. You show up and they're like, welcome to your first day at work on the graveyard shift. Will you survive? Here are the rules. We're going to take you into the kill zone. Rule number one, don't go into the kill zone. They're like, all right, we're going to go into the kill zone. So shout out to my friend Josh Randall for being a scary, crazy guy with amazing ideas. But I'm in the room. I'm in the kill zone, I think. At least I was last time. And these these people are on their first day on the job, and I'm a crazy worker in a haunted factory. Do I want to kill them? Do I want to eat them? Are they part of the slaughterhouse? Are they going to join me on the job? Or are they going to leave on the slab. And my character, I think I want to eat these people. I want to put them on the slab. So that's a feel. I mean, that's a weird, like, okay, I'm a killer now. Like, that's not who I am in real life. I am a nice person who wants to let people exist and be themselves. That's why I have a podcast about being yourself. I'm not a killer, but I love pretending to be one. And I
think this goes back to what I was saying about not acting out. I know you're acting, but I'm talking about acting out. You don't do it for real in the street. You're doing it in a fantasy way, and you're able to release it. And I totally agree with you, because if you hold that in, it could come out in all sorts of dangerous ways.
Yeah, it's pretend. That's the real thing. Is like we're creating an illusion of danger. That's actually okay. Here's the real thing. It's fear. It's fear for everybody. We're on different sides of the coin. These people walking through, they want to experience simulated death possibility. They want possibility, and this is the same for roller coasters. We want to simulate for our brains and for our bodies as close as possible the experience of coming close to death and surviving.
Sounds like doing a concert as well. Right? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I guess in the if any of those concerts, I guess I've had the privilege to the last bunch of concerts I've played have not been so terrifying. It's more just been like, let's make these people dance. The world is back. Let's make them dance. But yeah, the exposure to and survival of death is the human experience. And so if we're running towards fear instead of running away, I think that's something that we're releasing. So go, it's October right now. It is. Go to your local haunted house, support your local scare actors.
If only I was in the States, I would come. I totally would go and see it and be scared.
Yeah. So releasing fear, I think, is important. And what I'm struggling to figure out is, like, how do I bring that back into a musical performance? How do I get these same feelings? How do I get into that flow state? Because honestly, if I put on a mask and I'm scaring people, it's easy. When I'm on a mountain skiing and I feel the gravity, it's easy. Flow state is instant. And now the passion of my life, my work, my music, sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And
it's a great question, and it's a great curiosity that you can have. And, you know, when you're next doing an improvisation, go to the limits. Really, what can push you a little bit over the edge that you've never tried before that can really make your heart race? That can be scary, right?
Yeah. Fear and how do we harness it? That is the life question.
As a conductor, for me, it's one of those things that, you know, I don't know if you know the music of Béla Bartók. Bartók's music can be very rhythmic. Things can be in fives and then sevens and then fours and threes and then, you know, very weird rhythmic meters. And I've always thought I wasn't good at that stuff. So recently I've been just doing Bartók. I've been just going to it and just conducting it. And you know what? I love it. I love the sense of being on the edge, pushing to my limits. And it's actually, I wouldn't say I get comfortable with it now, but I feel much more at ease with that kind of music, that rhythmical music. Mm-hmm. So it's I'm doing something that scares me, but it's really great that it's just it's creating expansion and development in me.
That's the best feeling. Yeah. Odd times. Come on, America, let's get out of 4/4. These odd time signatures are where it's at.
Throw in a 7 and a 5. Mission Impossible is 5, right?
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, that's
in 5. Yeah, and you know it, and people can sing that. And it's a 5, and it's actually, you know, it's not complicated.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I'm an NPR listener. There's a lot of their theme music that happens in odd time signatures. Something about TV productions, I don't know what it is. Themes, like theme, especially news shows, really love odd time signatures. And
it's because the news is so uncertain, maybe.
I don't think most people are paying attention to the time signatures on their TV, but I am. Because, I mean, once you study music, you look at it in a whole new way. And just like the same way when you study anything, you can't go back to the way it was before because your world is so much bigger now. But yeah, man, Bartok, yes. This, I can say for a fact, this household loves Bartok, and we have listened to Bartok string quartets on vinyl as recently as like this past week.
Amazing piece.
With friends. Yeah. Just in our living room. And
and so very difficult to play. Oh, wow.
I love the violin duos. That's that's been a great as someone who exists on the outskirts of classical music, more as a composer than an orchestral musician, the Bartok duets have been a nice way for me to get into it.
What do you like about them?
I like that the melodies are, it's the music that I'm looking for. It's got folk melodies done weirdly. And that has actually been the course of my life. That's what I do. And so it's a inspiration to hear what he does with harmony and offsetting rhythms with something that starts out so simple. I think it's brilliant. And so that, I mean, it's basically what I aspire to do when I play music is be like Bartok.
Perfect fit for you. Perfect. And you're exploring your shadow side as well along with it, right? It's like kind of like, you know, what's going on with this? You know, for me, it's definitely, Bartok is definitely an exploration of my shadow side. This kind of fear of order and just regularity. Suddenly it becomes irregular. And what happens with that? You know, what happens when you can't control it so much?
Wow. Yeah, totally. I think I experience more imposter syndrome when I play classical music than most other genres, just because I know that I went to Berklee College of Music, so I could take all the gigs that the conservatory people couldn't, because I can read a chord chart and play with the songwriter and it's fine. But like, who am I? Like, I didn't go to conservatory. I, like, when I was at Berklee, they were like, nothing conservatory about it on a big billboard. So I'm like, I'm not a classical musician, but I grew up playing violin with Suzuki and like in my school orchestra, and my school orchestra with so many great orchestra teachers who encouraged me, including like Janet Haas at Lexington High School, who encouraged me to write a piece for our orchestra, and then we played it, and now amazing. It's published on Wingert Jones. I mean,
amazing.
Like, yeah, anything's possible, I guess. But even looking back to that, I didn't even know about music theory. I didn't know what I was doing, and I still did it, which is sort of the central thesis of The River of Suck, which is you can do something before you know how to do it. Yeah. And we need to stop folk. This is what my last guest, Olivia Mickle, talked about so much. Like, do it before you're good. You might love it. If you love it, then you should be doing it, regardless of if you're good at it.
It's interesting that because conservatories around the world are now realizing that the orchestral model is a little bit outdated. Not the music is wonderful, but things are moving differently. There are more musicians like yourself who are now leaving conservatories and wanting to do more popular stuff, not necessarily just classical. And now there's a real seismic shift in the way this is showing up in conservatories. It's not all about classical anymore. I'd say that actually some of the American conservatories are a bit behind the times, but certainly some of the Asian and European conservatories are really moving in very refreshing directions.
Yeah.
Exactly, supporting musicians like yourself who do want to do both.
Right. Because when it comes down to it, music is music, and all these borders are artificial.
There you go.
Things. I think music is from the universe.
It is. Like, music of the spheres.
Where are we to put it all in boxes?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the refreshing thing about that we're moving into this 21st century idea of a concert, of an orchestral concert. What features in those things now? You can now have all kinds of genres side by side in a program, and no one's really right. going to bat an eyelid. And that's really wonderful. I love that.
And besides genres, we're finally, I believe, moving. There's still a long ways to go, but we're finally seeing more programmers, directors choosing to feature more music not written by dead white males. And I think that's right. really important yeah. for yeah. the growth of sort of orchestras and the direction of so-called classical music or
And that's the repertoire dilemma you've just pointed out, that I spend my life conducting pieces by dead white men. and that is a huge problem that we're facing. Because, mm-hmm. you know, what about, you know, black composers? What about Asian composers? Right. How can we create a repertory that's fitting, that befits 21st century philosophy, thought, culture? How can we do that? And a lot of these conservatories now that I was talking about are thinking this way, are moving in this direction. You right. know, what about female composers who've been neglected for so long, right? Yeah. Mahler made his wife give up composing. Can you believe it? I didn't know this. He told Alma Mahler, I won't marry you unless you give up composing. And she was a very gifted composer.
That is, I'm going to bleep myself later. That is bleeped up.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, and we find ourselves now in this dilemma. And so we need to start. And I also need to rethink the way, because I love dead white men's music. I love conducting it. I have to be honest. I love Beethoven. Sure. I love Strauss. I love Mahler. But what about other stuff? How can I start to bring in other music? How can I start to bring in other genres, film music, pop music, jazz, in concert, side by side?
Are you in positions where you're selecting the music, or are you in more situations? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Quite often I am. And so, and in a conservatory, I need to obviously make sure that the students have fun in orchestra, that they play, you know, core repertoire that when they leave, and if they get orchestra jobs, that they may play. But like I said, orchestras now are experimenting with lots of different stuff. So I'd like to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the power rests with the people in power.
You're right. Yeah, you're totally right. You know, I mean, yeah, you see very... Esa-Pekka Salonen is doing really, really fantastic, interesting things, you know, in orchestras in America, in Chicago. Mm. He's coming up with really refreshing programs. And so I think people are in power are looking at things differently now.
Well, in a way, it's sort of the same thing as what we've been talking about with fear and everything. We have to, in the flow states, we have to think about it, yeah. or the thing that will happen by default will not be as good as where it could be if we really gave it some thought. So, you know, let's try and be better every day. Try and make ourselves and the world a little bit better, just that's like right. one day at a time.
Yeah. Stop denying things. Stop denying the climate crisis. Stop denying that we, you know, that we have a need to share music. And, you know, music is our lifeblood, and we want to share it. At the end of the day, we do music because we want to share it. Mm-hmm. I'm just a fool waving a stick around. If I don't have an audience there, you know what, right? So it's, you know.
I love this image of a composer on a podium with no orchestra and no audience.
Conductor, yeah, exactly.
Like the White Room or something. Just like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it's my ego. I'm just stroking my ego and stroking my narcissism. Healthily. <It's>
like, oh my gosh. Wow. Well, I have a really healthy respect for composers. I have a really healthy respect for conductors, because that was one of my least favorite things to do at Berkeley. I took conducting 1 and 2, but I'm like, I write music and I play music and I don't want to conduct it. So I don't want to like pay attention in this class, and I don't want to practice, and I don't want to do well. And then I found out that as a composer, I would show up to school orchestras and they'd want me to conduct my piece.
There you go.
Like, why did I run away from that? Now I need to do it, and I have less tools. Oh no.
There are so many famous conductor composers, Mahler, Bernstein, you know, Esa-Pekka Salonen as well. He's, you know, a famous conductor. He's also composing great music and a really fantastic conductor as well. So, yeah, there are lots of composer conductors. Why did you, were you fearing the podium time?
I think I was. I think I'm afraid of conducting. I am afraid of conducting. And and that's why I have such a respect for people who want to be there. And like, that's like you're choosing to do that. I think that's incredible.
What's most scary about it for you?
You know, it's all the same. Well, it's literally the same. It's all the thought piranhas. Why am I up here when someone else has studied conducting more than me? What will they think when I wave my hands in a different way than someone who's more trained than me? Why can't I just sit back and listen to the orchestra play my piece? Why can't I be a passive? Why do I have to be like, I did the work, I composed this. Why do I have to still be, what am I doing here? Why me? Why not somebody else?
I mean, to be fair, I know a lot of composers that actually don't want to conduct their own music because they want that distance from it to enjoy it from the concert hall,
right.
not to be terrifyingly in it, on the podium. So I get right. that. I mean, because I'm also a composer, right? In my past days, and mm-hmm. I remember I had a piece played by this group called the London Sinfonietta, really fantastic modern music group, and
cool.
I wasn't conducting it. But my piece was being played by them. And I have to say, that's one of the most nervous times I've ever experienced. It was like suddenly everyone was going to listen to your thing that you lovingly created. And and they were going to criticize it and they were going to see it and they're going to poke holes in it. And I was so terrified. And all I had to do was sit there in the audience and enjoy it. But I couldn't. I mean, is that how do you feel when your music's being played and you're a member of the audience?
I guess you're noticing everything and I just want to like look around and I just want everyone to have a good experience.
Right.
Listening. But there's things that you're aware of that nobody else is that you can't stop thinking about.
You're in the river of suck in that moment, right?
Yeah. gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Then you're sitting in your seat. You're in your seat. You're like strapped in. You're like, I can't move. I can't speak. And all I'm doing is worrying.
Yeah. And you can't leave because people go, why is he leaving? Isn't he the composer? So it's like, you know, you're there, right?
I would be there for all the mistakes. But, you know, the thing is, and it really comes back to time because I feel a lot more comfortable now than I used to be going into that situation. I feel like I can be up there and not be a professional conductor and still be conducting. And that's a big leap for me. I'm the composer. I'm qualified. I made the music. I deserve to be here.
Yeah.
They're not judging my conducting skills. They're trying to play music. And especially like I really love school string orchestras. That's my jam. So they're probably barely even, I mean, those kids, they barely even look up from their music anyway. So it's a big act. It's a dance. And you're really up there to guide the music. And so let's, what is the purpose? Maybe you can speak to this. You're not just guiding the music. You're a leader. Like what does being a leader mean to you? And what have you learned from conducting about being a leader?
How I see it is that I want to spread a virus, not a COVID-19, but a virus that everyone catches and spreads to everyone else in that orchestra. And suddenly everyone is infected and suddenly everyone realizes, wow, they like feel this energy in the room, you know, and suddenly, and the piece comes alive or feel this sadness or calmness in this moment. So that's what I like doing, infecting everyone. I know it sounds bizarre, but it's how not, it is.
It's not what I expected. but you're getting people on the same page who you're talking about turning a lot of separate egos into one organism.
There you go. Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. Because everyone in that orchestra, I respect, everyone has started learning since they were, I don't know, 5 or 6. Everyone's practiced thousands of hours. I'm not going to take that away from them. I want to just let them enjoy that space and enjoy the professionalism, enjoy them being in the moment of playing wonderfully in whatever mood. But I need to kind of bring them together, and I kind of need to unify that diversity of thought and persona and, like you say, ego. I need to unite that. And one way is being infectious, like I was saying, being infectious on the podium, maybe dancing with them so they really feel this energy. Gustavo Dudamel does this all the time, and people are infected by him all the time. The musicians love him because they just love this energy, or the calmness that emanates from the podium.
Yeah. So I have a term for that, actually.
What's the term?
Vibe wizards.
Vibe wizards. Yeah, totally. He's a vibe wizard.
Sounds
you're
like
a vibe wizard.
Well,
yeah, there. Yeah. You know, so for me, that's an important part of the job. It was funny because I was actually doing a leadership talk today for a well-known multinational company about what it, you know, leadership through the lens of a conductor and orchestra. And one of the things I say is that, you know, you have to, it's about being a better me and a better us together. Yeah. But you have to know about yourself in order to be able to persuade all these wonderful people to listen to each other and to listen to you as well.
That's right.
And it takes skill. It doesn't take aggression. It sometimes takes firmness, but not aggression. Huh. It sometimes takes hard work and dedication and a lot of patience and a lot of compassion. There's a lot of suffering that will go on in a rehearsal. So be with that.
Wow. Well, geez, you really summed it up there. That's amazing.
We suffer for our art, don't we, Andy?
Yeah. Any artist must love suffering to be a professional. Yeah. Otherwise, art, you know, for most people as a hobby, art is not about suffering. It's about creating, and it's about passion. And then suddenly when you want to be a professional, it becomes about suffering. Like, that is weird. That is really weird.
It's that fine line, isn't it? It's that suddenly you step over and it's this other territory. Yeah.
Love it so much that you're willing to suffer.
Yeah.
Because you think it'll be worth it.
Yeah. And some people get so irate because it's so important to them. So they want to say, but we need to play this like this, or it's really out of tune. We need to get it right. And so I really admire and respect that. I respect that passion and dedication. Sometimes it can get, you know, too much, and maybe we need some time out from that. But on the whole, when you're dealing with serious musicians who want to perform well, that's just a wonderful space to be in.
Wow. Super cool. Yeah. You're in quarantine in a hotel room in Hong Kong.
I am.
That's part of why I was like, he's sitting there in a hotel room, and like I desperately needed someone for this month because my last interview got canceled for someone who got sick. This is just the world now. People are canceling things when they're sick instead of going to them and infecting everyone. So I had my last interview just got canceled, and we're trying to reschedule it. I'm like, really trying to get back to this monthly thing. So when you said where you were, I was just like, Jason, I got him. He's trapped. I can get him to say all the good because he's not going anywhere.
Exactly. I'm a captive audience. Yes.
But the bizarre thing is that means that I woke up extra early, and last night I told Joy, I was like, I'm sorry about the alarm that's going to go off. She's like, why are you waking up early? River suck. I got to wake up so we began at 9 a.m. for me, which is 11 p.m. for you. I mean, it's the beginning or the end of the day.
Absolutely.
We're on opposite sides of the world right now.
You really are. And I'm a night person. I don't know. Are you a morning? You're not a morning person.
Is skiing involved? I'm a morning person.
Okay.
Is skiing not involved? I hate the morning.
Okay.
Actually, I do love, you know, I'm trying to love the morning. First off, I'm roasting coffee now. That is one of my big pandemic hobbies that I've been passionate about that is going to stick with me forever. I'm home roasting coffee. So every day I get to wake up and make more coffee that I've roasted and drink it and taste it and feel alive. And
that's and smell awesome. It. Yeah.
Yeah. Smelling it, tasting it.
Yeah.
Starting your day. It's just, it's, I love it. But at the same time, the night is filled with possibility.
It really is, isn't it?
Darkness.
Yeah.
Darkness. But I don't always want to practice. I want to create. So I'm trying to practice singing right now. And I think if I wait till night, I don't do the hard stuff. Maybe I'll sing a song that I'm working on or writing, but I need to practice nitty gritty, like hard work practice. And so we'll see. Now I'm saying this in public, so I'm going to really have to stick with it. But this week I decided that I'm going to wake up early to practice singing. So we'll see how that goes when I have to wake up even
earlier. Can't wait to hear it.
To go. Yeah. But
and do you have this kind of really sexy horsey voice in the morning, you know, like waking up voice?
Oh man. Well, I'm the voice and how it sounds is one of the things I'm trying to be more aware of. I think I've gone through a lot of my life just talking the way, just speaking how it comes, not thinking about it. And that's led to a lot of me being people misunderstand my tone. They think I'm angry. I have resting angry voice.
What kind of tone is that then? Tell me, I mean, what's your angry? What's the tone that they think is angry?
It's whatever happens when I don't think about it, which is really hard to repeat right now because I'm thinking about it. And you know what? The best thing ever for me to ever lead into this more of the acting thing is to podcast. As a musician who thought I was going to be an instrumental performer and I did not practice singing, I quickly learned that singing was something that people want to hear and that songs with words and stories are meaningful to people.
They really are. People love stories. They love songs.
So yeah. I want to be a part of that, but it is not coming without, I'm deep in the river of suck right now. Let's put it that way. where I am on a path and I'm going somewhere, but I'm not there yet. And the there yet is I want to be a professional level singer. I want people to hear my voice and be like, that's an amazing voice. So I know where I want to be. And I know from some recent experiences that I'm not at the level that I could be with more practice and more time and more suffering and patience.
You're not there yet. Yeah,
exactly. I'm trying to listen to my own advice, which is the hardest thing. And you know this as a coach. You can tell somebody to go do something, and it might be something that you know will work if they do it. Yeah. But do you do all those things? Are coaches perfect people?
Yeah. It's like leading the horse to the water. You can lead the horse to water, but you can't make it drink, right? So it's totally like that. And it's funny because whenever I have coaching clients, I always say to them that, you know, I'll be giving you exercises and practices that I would like you to seriously attempt to do. Because simply, if I sit in front of a piano and expect a Beethoven sonata to come to me through osmosis, it's never going to happen. I literally have to move my fingers and practice every day. And what I think is wonderful about musicians is that we're used to practicing. But a lot of people in the world aren't used to practicing. They find it very strange to practice something every day.
Right.
Whereas we're very used to it. So I think musicians have a head start on that.
Do you have a good practice routine?
I think I do. Well, I'm practicing a lot of self-awareness all the time, every day. So I'm meditating. I'm trying to meditate every day. If I don't meditate silently, I do walking meditation, or the awareness meditation is so important to me. What I love about my work is that it's so varied. So one day I'll have a rehearsal, maybe a concert. Another day I'll have a coaching. Another day I'll do an online presentation. Another day I'll do a workshop. Mm-hmm. Another day I'll be filming something for TV. I love that variety in my life, and I'm so blessed and so grateful that I have that variety. And so it's almost hard to know what a normal day looks like, but there are certain things that I know that I can come back to myself, back to my breathing. I practice my breathing a lot. My breathing, I do a lot of inhaling and longer exhaling, because it really calms down the nervous systems in your body. So, and I get quite a lot of energy and nervousness, even for doing this podcast. I was kind of like nervous at the beginning, you know, even for concerts, I get nervous. I think that it's a healthy energy, but sometimes your nervous system, I don't want it to get it overwhelmed. So this breathing practice is really important. So I practice that a lot. Yeah.
Well, and in some ways, if you're making your daily life part of your practice, then you're always growing.
Yeah.
And it's not like you don't have to sit. This is the growth mindset that, or you said the other day, like the beginner's mind.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So we're always learning. And if you can't make time for practice because you're busy, then our life is practice for the rest of our life.
I remember once a meditation teacher said to me, and I said, oh yeah, I don't have time for meditation today. I'm so busy. That's the time you need to meditate, Jason. And it suddenly dawned on me. He was absolutely right. When you are the most busiest, when you are the most frenetic and you can't breathe, that's the time to take the time out, right?
Yes.
That's when you need it the most. Support yourself. Be kind to yourself.
Yeah.
Because we spend so much time being unkind to ourselves, my sense is. You know, through the clients that I coach, I spend a lot of time listening, of course, very deeply. And it breaks my heart sometimes at some of the things that I hear, because it feels like they're not being kind to themselves. They've learned to be unkind. They've learned to switch off that compassion, that self-compassion. And so that really won't help you in your daily practice. The thought piranhas will be devouring you mercilessly. And so to have that time to yourself, to have that quietness, to get that coffee and walk down the street without without headphones in your ears, just being at peace with yourself and the world. Just try it out for 5 minutes. Don't look at your phone for a bit.
Everyone has 5 minutes that they're looking at their phone that they could not be looking at their
phone. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And something I'm trying to put into practice now, that every time I have a desire or a sudden urge to do something, like pick my phone up, I hold off. I say to myself, nope, not right now. So I delay that gratification. And so that dopamine that's always, and Andy's looking at his phone right now. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, so that dopamine level that you get from being on your phone all the time, you need to kind of let that die down a little bit and reset. So if you have the urge to keep looking at your phone, and by the way, apparently studies have shown that we look at our phones on average 81 times a day, 81 times a day.
And that's the average. So a lot of people, it's a lot more.
Yeah, I can't quite believe that. But I mean, if they're doing studies on it, I guess, you know.
I believe it. I was in a restaurant the other day, and I saw a family sitting at a booth with two kids who were both 100% engrossed in like tablets.
And
it's just like, this is weird. This is family dinner time now. Or it was
heartbreaking. Yeah. It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Like, that's not. There's no sense of being present with the people around you.
Yeah. So, and being present with yourself.
And I know, I know a lot of families are struggling with that, because not everyone is on the same page of like phone use.
Yeah.
The people there's like a struggle, right, between the people who want to use the phones less and the people who want to use the phones more. And so I think mealtime is a good place to start with not having phones. And then the story leads to the picture, or the question about looking it up leads to Google, and then everyone's whipping out their phones, and it's just, it's 2021 and here we are.
So, but I agree with you. Having that sense of family, well, firstly, eating around the table, which is what people don't do apparently now. They're in different rooms. They go to their bedroom, or that, you know, or they sit in front of the TV. We've lost that communal sense of being together, that kind of spiritual, soulful time where we can be at one with each other and share, not in a religious way per se, but just share our food together, right?
Is that global? I mean, you're in China right now.
Yeah.
Is it the same? Are the same things happening in China?
Well, Western culture is creeping into Asian culture, you know, day by day. You know, now we have here, we didn't used to have much dairy stuff here in you know, in Hong Kong, in China. Now you see shelves and shelves of dairy and you see shelves and shelves of yogurts and stuff. And apparently that's affecting the health of Asian population because, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? And so, but I still, we Asians do tend to enjoy communal meals together still, but there is that sense that people do eat away and it's becoming de rigueur that, you know, that's what happens. So I would hate to lose that because I used to love that when mum, dad and my brother and sister, we used to eat around the table and we didn't have, sometimes there wasn't much to say, but it was just that sense of having your family or a family around you. It could be your friends eating together. I love that soulful sense. I think we've lost touch with the soul of life. Mm. We're now in the reasoning or the data of life. You know, it's all up here. And technology, as we were discussing the other day, is a wonderful thing. It really has helped us, enriched our lives, but it can also take over our lives as well. So one has to be aware and be careful, right? Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I don't want to go all night or all day.
All night for me, all day for you.
That's right. But, yeah. I do have one more question that I was really burning deep that I have to ask you. After your concert, when you've got the endorphin rush of performing and it's over and you talk to the people, what do you do next to keep that feeling? Or what do you personally do after it's all over? The lights are off.
Right.
What happens next?
Well, so you go back to your changing room, you get dressed and everything, and people kind of say hi to you and stuff. And then usually you go out to eat because usually I'm starving after a concert. I'm so ravenous because I haven't, you know, I don't want to conduct on a heavy, a full stomach because you get tired and stuff and it can weigh you down. Mm-hmm. And then curiously enough, what used to happen is I used to get really depressed. Because after the rush of endorphins, after that rush of adrenaline has gone down, it really made me spiral downwards.
Wow.
And now it doesn't happen so much because I'm aware of it. And I sit with that kind of sense of calming myself down gently. So I actually like to, after I've had dinner with friends, I actually like to go home and just sit in silence for a bit.
Wow.
I just like to be with myself, with my thoughts, because invariably the monkey mind is going, wonder what went well. Did that go well? You just want to calm that down. I don't actually meditate per se, but I get into a meditative state and I just want some peace and quiet before I, you know, shower and go to sleep. And invariably, I find it hard to get to sleep as well. But lately, after the concerts, I can settle myself down better and I get a good night's rest.
Wow, cool. I'm really glad I asked that question.
What do you do?
What do I do? Well, one of the things that I've noticed is that music can happen at all times of the day and for different reasons. So as the skiing fiddler in Colorado, I'm looking for the weird gigs sometimes. But you know, I like to eat. I like to go out to eat after, or make a good meal. Depends on where you are, you know. I think sometimes I reach for a beer and I'm not convinced that that's always the best choice, but also as a home brewer, I love the taste and I'm a nerd about it and I know what I'm tasting and why and how they did it, or I want to know. You know, sometimes we're trying to, like, in a way, we don't want to come crashing down. So how do we not come crashing down? Do we fill it with something, or do we fill it with quietness? Is quietness loud? Quiet can be loud.
It can be.
I think, okay. I hadn't thought about this. I just wanted to know what you thought. But I think especially after a louder concert, and concerts are getting, music is getting louder and louder.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah.
Speakers are getting better. And we have friends at QSC and they make the best speakers and whatever. But, like,
but just turn them down a bit, please.
I think I want a quiet place, whether the dinner is quiet or whether I need contrast. I need something. I don't want to go to a loud bar where people are yelling at each other because the music is so loud. I want something with sonic space.
Yeah.
So, like, with different music or no music from what just happened.
I want the space to be able to reset. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And gosh, it's hard. It's hard coming off of the best moment or the worst moment. What do you do next?
Exactly. What do you do next? And what you just said is, like, let's not try to distract ourselves and be there with what went on and just kind of go, okay, this is how I'm feeling right now.
Yeah.
We're very good at distracting ourselves, Andy. We're very good at that.
Yeah, I've been hearing this productive procrastination word thrown around a lot. I heard it through a composition student of mine who came in with a tune called Productive Procrastination. I'm like, oh gosh. Okay. Okay. Yes, I know exactly what that is. Okay. Everyone knows what that is.
Yeah, totally.
Oh man. I really appreciate your time and being so open with your life and your experiences. So I just want to thank you for being
here. It's my pleasure. And Andy, I just love your sense of curiosity. I love that about you. I now know that you're a brewer, you're a barista, you know, you love skiing, you do haunted house. I think that's just, you're just really enjoying life. And I think that's what it's about. I mean, I don't know, maybe we got 30, 40 years left. Let's enjoy it.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can do with it.
So if people want to find you on the internet or in real life, where do they go?
They can go to my website, jason-lai.net, right? And they can go to my Instagram, jcwlai. I'm on Facebook as well. So they can reach me. And on the contact page of my website, you can reach me through various different agents and also reach me directly. And I'll be happy to talk to anyone to answer questions. That'd be great.
Continue the conversation.
Yes. And so thank you so much for inviting me on your show. This river hasn't felt sucky at all. And it just, you know, and I just long to swim more in this river. So yeah, thank you so much.
Well, no one ever said crossing the river of suck would be easy or that you'd have to do it alone. So thanks for tuning in and give it a chance. You can join the River of Suck swim team for just $1 a month at riverofsuckswimteam.com and get sweet, sweet bonus content like any of this that I deleted, secret bonus content, and more, and lots of fun. So thank you, listeners. And do you have any final thoughts they should go out on?
You're not broken.
That's the title. This episode is called You're Not Broken. Till next time,
keep swimming. We learn. Whichever freestyle, breast, whichever stroke you want to do, keep swimming.
Swim lessons.
That's right. Put on your armbands, have those paddle floats, but keep swimming. Maybe, oh, maybe leave the banana hammocks at home, but keep swimming. Keep swimming.
Oh my gosh.
The musical clips in this episode were conducted by Jason Lyon, performed by the YST Conservatory in Singapore. Since we met as panelists on a fireside chat hosted by 12 Petals, I asked them for a few words about their mission. 12 Petals is a community dedicated to accelerating the growth and nourishing the well-being of aspiring and professional young individuals in the music, arts, and education industries. We believe in building meaningful connections and creating more global opportunities by empowering and uplifting others, as well as looking at music, education, and life from different lenses. Our team and mentors bring decades of experience in many genres in the performance, pedagogy, communications, arts management, administration, marketing industries, and more. 12 Petals is created both for the mentors and mentees, and we are dedicated to creating a healthier ecosystem that empowers and uplifts others through music and education. Learn more at www.weare12petals.com. That's the number 12 as a number, weare12petals.com. We are back in the monthly episode groove here at River of Suck Podcast. If you've made it this far, please consider leaving a review wherever you listen. That's it for today. You're not broken!